Save big money when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior wood stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture. It repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Our knowledgeable team is ready to help bring your dreams to life, 1 gallon at a time. Stop by your local Menards today.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
All right, comments are open. Nolan Wells' independent autopsy came back undetermined. No fractures, no deep tissue injuries, no lacerations. But the pathologist couldn't rule out foul play either because Mississippi retained the neck structures from the first autopsy, which, by the way, is 1,000% normal and protocol basically for an autopsy of how these sort of things function. It's not an outlier as some may try to present it to be. This is how it works. You can't peel an orange two times. You get one first chance at it, and then a second autopsy is kind of like that. We're going to go through where things are at from the middle and still saying, we don't know, because the autopsy is just one piece of this puzzle. The phone's going to tell us a lot. There's other things that are going to tell us a lot, but this is definitely a piece that's in. Joining myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis to help us break down what's going on. Two autopsies deep, and nobody can say how this kid died. The first autopsy results, we do not have the results from as of yet, or the toxicology as of yet, because that does still take some time. So what exactly, once we do convene a grand jury here, what does a grand jury do with we don't know, now that we have one of the autopsies in? The independent pathologist says Mississippi kept the neck structure, so he can't rule out strangulation. They're going to look at that. Does undetermined actually help this family get answers, or does it just keep this door open basically forever, Eric?
You know, I lean more towards it keeping the door open indefinitely at this point. You know, the autopsy does not make any affirmative conclusions that would be overly helpful to a grand jury. In another sense, it doesn't rule things out. So there are options to consider in terms mm-hmm. of trying to ascertain what happened here. But does it really move the needle? Is it going to be the difference between a grand jury indictment and what's called a no true bill? It's not going to be that difference.
What's a no true bill?
That's where a grand jury reviews the evidence and determines that there is not probable cause to bring any criminal charge.
What do you think it would take to get to there, vice the other directions? And I'm going to layer multiple questions. So take whatever you want, Eric, on this one. You know, in that area, as well as what do you think the family and the public could want to see between these two autopsy results to say, and for the public to say, yeah, there's nothing here other than a tragic
death. Something there. Right, what would, I guess, pull that needle in whatever direction other. It goes?
Something that is evidence of something more than just what could be interpreted as an accidental drowning. If there's evidence of some sort of injury, some sort of damage to the body, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about the mm-hmm. findings in detail, but that would be helpful. Also, some sort of evidence of criminal activity, meaning like a witness saw something, heard something, there was an altercation, there was an argument, something like that, that they can actually tie in a compelling way to this incident. Right now, we just don't have that stuff.
How important is it to a grand jury? Because that is step one for folks who are playing along at home. A grand jury, you're not convicting someone. It's the next step to going down a criminal path, if there is one to go down, or determining, no, there's nothing criminal here. That's the true bill or not true bill determination. But to get there, when they're looking at all the evidence here in an autopsy being one of many pieces of evidence that a grand jury will look at. They're not convening one until the investigation essentially has come to a bit of a close. So that'd be when we have the toxicology and when they have the first autopsy results and when they have the phone data in. When they have all that, they will convene the grand jury and put it out there. So there'll be a lot in front of them. But one of those things will be the autopsy. So when we get to a grand jury and they're looking at all the evidence, how much weight does a grand jury put on an autopsy, and how readily smart are they, for lack of a better term, how good are they at deciphering typically the weight of the autopsy versus digital evidence, digital footprints, and information that's out there? How do grand juries deal with autopsies today?
Sure. So an autopsy can be pivotal. You know, it can provide the grand jury with evidence. One of the central functions of an autopsy is to determine the cause of death and manner of death. Cause of death is usually has sort of a medical basis. Was a person shot? Did their heart stop? What was the cause medically? Manner of death is like, is this a homicide, meaning an unlawful killing? Was it an accident? Was it undetermined? So those things can be really helpful. But when the conclusion of the autopsy is undetermined, it really doesn't leave the jury with a lot to work off of on that front. And then in terms of evaluating the strength of that evidence as compared to other evidence like witness statements, digital forensics, things like that, we hope that the prosecutors would present all of that and try to explain it in some cogent fashion. But grand jury proceedings are somewhat secret. It's really the prosecutor or the grand jury. We don't know exactly what could be going on if that happens. So it's hard to say how the jury might receive evidence because we don't know exactly how it'll be presented and characterized.
Eric, with when it comes to the autopsy, they're going to be obviously getting the autopsy results from the government. Are they also going to get autopsy results from the private autopsy, or is it just going to be the government side?
That's a darn good question, Robin, because that's kind of an issue that a lot of people have with grand jury proceedings is that, one, it's so secret, and two, it's one-sided. It's only the prosecutor, and they kind of get to decide what they want to give this grand jury and have them evaluate. So, you know, at least in theory, a prosecutor could decide, hey, I like this first autopsy. I don't like the second one so much, or vice versa, and present only one of the autopsies, which I think would be a disservice to the grand jury and to the sense of justice. But the fact that they even have that option is concerning to some.
Yeah. And then, so what's the prosecutor trying to, I mean, what's their intent in doing the grand jury? Are they trying to move to trial? Are they trying, you know, is there a confirmation bias that prosecutors are trying to do or not trying to do? Or, I mean, show us how the sausage is made a little bit about what they're trying to accomplish during the grand jury.
Also an important question because there can be different objectives that prosecutors have in bringing a grand jury. One could be that they think they have probable cause and they want it to get rubber stamped by a grand jury to move forward with a criminal charge. Another could be that they are unclear as to whether they have probable cause and they need to get sort of a second set of eyes on this. A third could be that they don't want to make the decision themselves because there could be a public uproar. So let me punt this decision to these, unwitting grand jury members of the public and it can be on their heads with whatever happens.
Obviously, every case is different that goes in front of a grand jury. But statistically speaking, because grand juries are so secretive, most people don't really fully understand them. I mean, I only understand them from what I've learned over the last however many years talking with y'all. Is there a rate at which, like, what percentage of cases that go to a grand jury, which are far more than we're aware of, actually end up facing criminal prosecution versus a grand jury saying a no true bill, meaning there's nothing to prosecute here?
Totally. On that question, you know, there's this old adage in the law that you can indict a ham sandwich, meaning you can. Meaning it's so easy. It's so easy.
It's good.
To obtain an indictment. One, the standard is super low. It's probable cause. Are there reasonable grounds to believe a crime was committed and that someone else committed it? And two, the prosecutor is steering the entire ship. They get to decide exactly what the grand jury sees. And so the likelihood of an indictment once a case is presented to the grand jury is very high. And that's why there's been a lot of sort of surprise in terms of some of these DOJ efforts to get an indictment and then failing to do so. That's rather uncommon. So charges are common once it's presented to the grand jury.
Does this have to go to a grand jury? Is that just like, without a doubt, no matter what, because we don't know exactly what happened to him, it's going to land in a grand jury's lap? Regardless, just to basically cross the T's and dot the I's?
It depends on the state, but nearly all states allow the prosecution to proceed by complaint and information instead. So the prosecutor typically could make the determination themselves, could say, hey, I think we got probable cause here. I'm going to file these charges. I'm going to move forward in that fashion without the grand jury even being involved. But usually when it's a closer call, and also when there is sort of a national fervor about the case, that they'll punt it to the grand jury and have them make the decision so that the prosecutors can kind of say, hey, public, if you don't like the decision, well, it wasn't us. It was the grand jury. Sorry.
Robin's got stats. I can tell.
You're getting to read my tells. Yeah. Once a case reaches a grand jury with a prosecutor asking for charges, the odds of it moving the next phase indictment are extremely high, well over 99%.
Oh, well, there
so my,
you go.
So my question then is, who? I mean, so looking for an indictment, and if you've conducted at least 60 interviews from the last time we saw, and we've seen the videos of the... Well, I mean, I'll just describe it as mayhem. You have tons of boats, tons of people, tons of activity, tons of people that were interacting, mismatching all over the place. So if you're looking for an indictment, who do you go after? I mean, do you start with a fishing net? I mean, how's that work?
Does it have to be about a specific person?
Right, that's my question, right?
Yeah, or can it be... Something suspicious happened here. We still don't know who, but can a grand jury basically initiate the deeper investigation to try and find the answer to the who, or do they have to have a who in their sights before they issue a true bill?
You know, in the substantial majority of cases, law enforcement has what's called the target in a grand jury investigation. Right. That's the person they believe charges may be levied against. And it's for the grand jury to decide whether to charge the target and to charge other folks, too. So almost always they already have somebody in mind. However, grand jury investigations are just that proceedings are investigative in nature, in the sense that the grand jury can issue subpoenas themselves. The grand jury could say, hey, you know what? We want to hear from this dude in the red shirt in this video. We think he might have information. Let's subpoena him to come tell us what he knows. They can do the same thing with documents, with forensic digital stuff. And so it can really be an investigative tool to get to the truth, but usually you have at least some target in mind when you're bringing it from the outset.
And probably, and correct me if I'm wrong on this too, because the way my mind works when doing investigations always is I'm looking for the wobbles. And so would they be then the prosecutor basically saying, hey, you know, if I'm looking at an equal field, say I have a couple hundred people and I brought it to a grand jury, and like you said, they're going to kind of direct in a certain area. They're basically looking for at least one or a couple of people that kind of, not that they thought they necessarily did anything wrong, but that's where they want to be able to dive deeper because they saw a little bit of a wobble of behavior. Maybe they overheard a fight or someone recorded that, you know, someone had some issues with someone or just some sort of wobble. Is that enough for allow the prosecutor to say, all right, we're going to focus in this area, even if that through their investigation, it might not be over here, it goes over here?
Totally. I mean, they can have multiple potential targets in mind. You see this in like gang cases where they don't know who the shooter is, but there's, you know, there's this gang that was present. We know that there were five dudes there. Let's look more into these five folks and then narrow from there as we go. And a similar approach could be taken if this case was presented to a grand jury.
And then 30 years later, you finally are going to go to trial for the person who shot Tupac. Only 30 years to get there. Longer than he actually lived. 300 people estimated on Horn Island that day. 60 witnesses have reportedly been interviewed. Three friends cooperating, giving the statements. Those are the boys from the boat. Not one person out of hundreds has described seeing anything criminal happen to Nolan Wells. What does that tell you? If you're a defense attorney, like if you're in, let's just say this, if you're in the shoes of the parents here who are going through hell, their son just died. The world is saying, this is what happened. And the another half is saying nothing happened. And you're stuck in the middle because something's got to make sense here. As something happened to your son, you don't know what it is. But if you're trying to be objective here on the outside, and your interest is in the well-being of that family and 300 people, if something happened, you would think at this point, we're almost a month into this case, that somebody would have said something. It would be somewhere. You're not going to get that many people all shutting up simultaneously. It just doesn't happen that way. What does that tell you right now, you know, as an attorney and just as a person who's been around the law, been around cases, and you don't have any leakage right now of anybody remotely, as far as we can tell, that's coming out with anything that seems nefarious here?
You know, you start to think about what the potential explanations for this young man could be. And one of them, I suppose, is that this was completely an accidental drowning, and that I guess near this island or the water around it, where there were at least 100 people, according to videos, probably more than that. Zero people just saw this person go into the water for what reason, and then accidentally died, but didn't make any sound, didn't call for help. No one else saw that. I mean, that's one explanation, but how plausible is that? How reasonable is that? Does that comport with like what we understand about human nature and how groups react and these big events, things like that? It kind of doesn't. And so what it tells me is that someone must have seen something, heard something. I just can't fathom that this person, you know, would be in a group of folks talking, carrying on, and then jump in the water and drown without anybody seeing it.
If you're in a group and suddenly you get swept away, of course. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I don't see how people would not be able to talk about that or see that. You know, or even if there was a fight somewhere, I would think you'd have somebody, oh yeah, there was an altercation over there, unless it was very off to the side and nobody's noticing it, or he went into the water by himself in some corner of the island for a few moments and then got caught in a riptide. I mean, the reality is, I mean, yes, it does. I think that's really troubling about this case, is it does seem to contradict how we think about trauma, how we think about human behavior and fighting and all that in a land setting, in one that doesn't have riptides around you and boats and boat motors and lots of drunk people. A lot of drownings are exactly this. We don't know how they got out there or where they went away or when they went away because it is so silent. It's not typically flailing and raising your hands and, nope, we lost him. That's not how a lot of drownings go in reality. And I mean, if nobody is saying something because they didn't see anything, I mean, does that point more to that than anything else?
It certainly is suggestive of that. And I suppose that in theory, a person could go take a dip away from everybody else, not tell anybody. The other folks don't notice that he's doing that. He goes in and gets caught by a riptide, doesn't make any sounds or anything like that. That's possible. And, you know, at least at this juncture, if something did happen, like you said, I would expect at least one person would say something.
You think?
It's not some huge, you know, 200 person conspiracy cover up thing. That's not plausible either.
So
yeah, exactly.
I did some research. Key patterns from data and case reviews, and this actually one from Medical Examiner in Palm Beach County found that roughly, believe it or not, 70% of drowning deaths were unwitnessed when in large groups like this. 70%. So it's not unheard of, because when, you know, to Eric, what Eric was saying, when you have large groups of people and you have community pockets engaging with each other, the focus, remember, as a human being, we pick up things in peripherals, but we can only focus on one thing at a time. And so if you're in a small cluster groups or your boat cluster groups, you're not going to necessarily pick up, unless someone is over the top yelling, screaming, yelling, which if they're drowning, maybe not. I mean, again, it's hard to say conjecture, but the research says roughly 70%, at least up to that amount, are drownings with other people around, unbeknownst, especially if you have a strong riptide and stuff. So It's within plausibility. As much as I was with you on this, as much as it seems implausible, because when you have two implausible situations, where do you go?
Yeah.
But it's not totally implausible.
Yeah. There's just so many questions.
Sad.
That's this part of the segment. Encourage your thoughts and comments in the comment section, Substack and YouTube. The links are there in the description. We're going to continue talking about this. $125,000 in reward money is on the table for information leading to an arrest and conviction. But there's no arrest, no suspect, and no evidence a crime was even committed. Crump, the attorney for the family, announced the independent autopsy results at the NAACP National Convention in Chicago, not in Mississippi, where the investigation is actually happening. Does the machinery around this case serve the truth or the narrative? That's the question I think a lot of people are starting to ask here. We're going to ask it, too. Again, I want to say we don't know. We will follow this case wherever it goes. I'm not vested. Nobody here is vested in it being this way or that way. But I am vested in people not being taken advantage of people not being used for another agenda to tack on, because it's a lot of public attention right now. Sharpton and Tyler Perry put up $100,000 reward at the funeral. Terrell Owens added another $25,000. But a reward for arrest and conviction, it assumes a crime was committed, which as of right now, other than some conflicting statements of teenagers of he was going to go hang out with girls and he was going to go hang out with boys, when you publicly offer six figures before the autopsy is even back, you don't have the digital information back. A lot of assumptions are being made that Snapchat was deleted. That really has not been proven yet. It's all conjecture. All of it is conjecture. Other than the independent autopsy we have back, which is now inconclusive. But all of this, the reward offers, all of that came out before even that was out. What message does that send to a grand jury pool? Eric?
You know, I think that there are multiple problems potentially with these reward offers. And look, I get it. Folks stepping up and trying to get justice and offering their means that they have to try to help out this family. I completely understand that. On the flip side, though, the concern for me is that especially if the reward is for arrest and conviction, well, somebody hears that and they want $125,000. How do I get it? Well, I got to give information. What type of information? The type of information must be one of a criminal nature. It could be of an innocent explanation, because then I don't get the reward. So I'm worried that folks might tailor what they're reporting in a way that steers in the direction of them getting $125,000, regardless of whether there was a crime actually committed. And so I think that putting that qualifier on it, that arrest and conviction is how you get the reward, I think it really gives me pause about the reliability of such information that might flow from that.
Yeah, I face this in the Bureau a lot of times too, is it's a confirmation bias you're incentivizing because you're trying to fulfill something to get something in return for it. And I don't know why you'd need it to begin with, because why wouldn't people come forward with this? There's no motive to hide this information in a lot of people around there. So it's challenging, no doubt. I hope they don't need to do that, but it's fraught with some challenges, just because you then have to sift through what was the motivation to forward this information. Was it the money, or was it truth, justice? I mean, I think it adds potentially a complication. But also, I did research on this one too. It's common to do this. It's not uncommon for be incentivized before there's actually a target.
It's just interesting. I mean, how it could steer it in different ways. When it comes down to the motivations of everyone there, everyone involved. We've talked about this a little bit. People have been you'd think there'd be more video that would be out by now. But one of the big reasons that I think we've discussed here, why would someone, if you have video, even if it's not nefarious, it's just people partying out on the island, that can still tell you something. But a lot of people don't want to reveal that if they have any of it, because a lot of them are college kids and a lot of them are drinking and a lot of them are involved in things. And if, oh, suddenly the video comes out of you drinking, it might not bode too well. And that person might be going, I'm not losing my scholarship. I'm not losing my place on this team or this or that because of this shit show that went on over here or this accident that went on over here. I had nothing to do with it. I'm not going to sacrifice everything I've done because I had a couple drinks on a boat one day and something went horribly wrong over here. So there's a lot of independent levers that are being pulled for different motivational purposes here. I want to address a quick comment I saw there where it says Crump asking, what was it, white people to come forward. I want to address that because, look, Nolan was not the only black kid on the island that day. There was a lot. Because again, this is, and the groups of friends have talked about it. They're a very large, diverse group of people. This wasn't Clan Island, and he was the only black child on it. And he's an adult too. He's not a child. He's 18. So that was not this. And I think characterizing it that way, and I think a lot of people get that in their heads, that's not good. That's not healthy. Let's look at this from reality's standpoint. So if we're going to say, okay, asking people to come forward, you're asking every person on that island, anybody who's trying to come forward, and there was plenty of black people, and there was plenty of, you name it, there's a mixture of every type of human being on the thing, and they were all there to have a good time, if nothing happened here. So it's weird to think that, okay, if this is racially motivated, if something big happened, that you have literally gotten everybody of every spectrum, of every color of the rainbow, all together saying, nope, we're not going to talk because we somehow have it out for him because he's black. I just... It's a very strong narrative that's seeming at play here, and it just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, again, they're basing it off of photos of the island. And just, again, research, as you're saying, Tony. So he was the only black man amongst his friends.
On the three-person boat, they went out with many other boats with other friends, too.
So let's just go to Crumb's statement. It's like, you know, the people coming forward and sharing everything are his white friends. So that's already happening, and they're the ones being really forthright. So they're basing it off of just the photos that are coming from the island. And also, I know we're getting a lot of comments also on the deleted text.
We don't know that anything was deleted.
I know. That's what I'm saying. That's what everyone needs to be really, really challenge the information you get and interrogate it in the sense of, is it conjecture? Because it is, it's a wobble. The only where this came from, it's a wobble from the family saying, according to their context of their son and how he interacts with the world, it's strange that there's not more than what he had because they saw it as a wobble. But there's been zero law enforcement or zero confirmation from anyone that anything's been deleted. And so, and to say it's been deleted says that you that it's an affirmative fact that it has been. It's not been established whatsoever, and no one's indicated that yet. So always be careful to then go down roads of conspiracy theories that these things are deleted. No, that's why we interrogate that information. We do critical thinking around and say, all right, let's play this forward. I mean, live we do it. We do all the research nonstop before, after, during to see where the truth is.
Eric, how much is that phone going to be the end-all, be-all of this case once they get the forensic testing back on it? I mean, this feels like it's going to be stronger than the autopsy, stronger than any sort of other evidence. That thing's going to tell us everything. If there's shit deleted on that phone, all the way. Let's dig. But if we did, we don't know that yet. But if there is, that's something. That's weird if somebody's going in and deleting text messages for whatever reason on that day or Snapchats. That would be very bizarre. Are, but we don't know that yet. But again, how critical is his phone and the phones of his friends and the stories they tell to the story?
Totally. You know, in looking at it, an 18-year-old in our modern society, chances are they are using that phone regularly, like perhaps every few minutes or something like that. In fact, it can almost give like a real-time historical record of what that person was doing, what they were thinking about, what was going on in their head, things like that. And so we'll hopefully reveal GPS location. That happens with phones so long as there is the proper connectivity to to record that information, which is unclear in on an island. But GPS location, text messages he was sending and receiving, potentially emails, potentially social media activity, potentially web history searches. All of that could really piece together what he was doing and what he was thinking about in those moments if he was using it. Now, if he had left it on the boat for a significant period of time and was not interacting with that phone, then it's going to tell us less.
I think one thing they're going to be looking at with that, too, is then comparing not just Nolan's, but everyone else's phone on that island as well, too, to see if it's conforming to the pattern of everyone's phone. Was everyone's phone on the boat? Was everyone's phone clustered in the same area? Was the amount of traffic and texting that people typically did beforehand equal to what happened on the island or what happened afterhand? That's why, to your point, Eric, you know, people, especially this age group, are on those phones so much, transferring so much data, so much information, so much about themselves and how they're living, how they're interacting, their thoughts, ideas, that it's going to really be very, very telling both before, during, and after all these events to see and help direct, you know, where we need to focus in the investigation.
And that's going to be, I'm very curious, obviously, what's in his phone. I'm very curious what's on all the friends' phones, because there you're also going to be looking at communications, and not necessarily with his phone, amongst themselves. If there's some, mm-hmm. if something is being covered up here, they're going to find it. They're going to find it. I think it's wonderful that this phone is being downloaded and reviewed by two different sources, the official investigators and the independent investigators. Yep. I think that's wonderful. And that's very different than the autopsy. I mean, an autopsy, look, you can have whatever your intentions are. It is what it is. You can only do an autopsy the first time. There's no second first time for an autopsy. So it is what it is with a second autopsy. You're not going to get it in pristine condition. But what you do get with the phone is duplicate results. And that's not necessarily something that can be spun two different ways if there's something there or not. The friends who are with Nolan are getting death threats. A chancery judge, also the stepmother of one of them, which has led a lot of people to go, well, one of the kid's mom is a judge. Yeah, not the judge in this case, but yeah. I mean, again, I get why it goes like, well, that's weird. Yeah, it certainly feels, but it is what it is. I mean, people have jobs. Some of them are in the legal system. Had to post publicly about the threats her family has been getting. There's been AI-generated images and debunked videos are circulating as evidence. If the grand jury finds no crime here, who's accountable for what happened to those kids in the meantime?
Gosh, I'm not sure the justice system has a great answer to that. You know, if there was all of this fervor and some perhaps exaggeration, even fabrication, misleading statements, emotions going all over the place, these threats on top of that, if the threat rises to the level of criminality, then those folks could potentially be held accountable, but that's not terribly likely. And, it might just be at the end, we don't know exactly what happened. We don't have a case, civil or criminal, against anybody. And there is no justice for this tremendous loss. That could be the outcome.
I mean, we've seen cases where people are hell-bent saying, you're a criminal. You're a criminal. Karen Reed comes to mind. Dipshit turtle boy who walks around, you know, with a megaphone and attacking people. We're seeing that all play out and the conspiring that went on there. I'm not saying that that's what's happening here, because I believe this family is suffering and they're dealing with a lot of people with a lot of different motives. But you have people who are grandstanding, who are saying pretty harsh things about who are Nolan's closest friends. If they're getting death threats, if they can show that this has affected their life in some way, shape, or form, wherever that may be, however that may be, I guess what's the bar for them to go back and go after Crump?
Yeah.
I mean, that would be interesting. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, if this turns out to be nothing, stirring a pot where there is nothing to stir, or you don't have the information yet. Again, I've been all about dig, expose, if there's something to expose, but don't say there's shit where there's not shit. Or misstate things where there's things that shouldn't be misstated in ways that are going to get people riled up and going down a lane of something that doesn't exist. And he has certainly been doing that. And if it goes down that lane and there's bad shit that went on here, okay, then we're going down that lane. Then he was right. But if it turns out there was no foul play here, and this has all been going on, and these family have had to go through hell, and it will continue to follow them, because at the end of the day, people are still going to believe what they're going to believe no matter what comes out here. If you're the one stirring the pot, if you're the one with a call to action here, calling this criminal, and if it turns out not to be criminal, how liable are you as an independent attorney?
Yeah, you know, Crump goes after folks for being negligent all the time. Could he have been negligent in this instance? How that might look, Tony, is an argument such that, he was negligent in how he presented information and presenting information that might not have been substantiated, sometimes perhaps mischaracterizing things. Yeah. And then did that cause damages to another person? Well, if a person is receiving death threats because a high profile individual is stirring the pot and getting this perhaps inaccurate information out there. And then another question is it foreseeable for Crump if he's negligent in how he's presenting information, that might rile somebody up to do something inappropriate, like make a death threat against another person. If there is that negligence and there is causation and there's foreseeability, those are really the essential elements you need for a negligence case.
Is that the same thing as when someone, that old analogy people use of, you have free speech, but you can't pull a fire alarm and say there's a fire and people die because they're rushing out the door when there's no fire just because you wanted to see how people reacted?
I think that's a very on point analogy for this this scenario. If Crump has been less than responsible in how he's presented information, and he's getting information as it comes to him, and he is not he's by nature skeptical of law enforcement and the government, the information they're providing. So he's getting his own information. Sometimes it's conflicting. Sometimes a piece is substantiated, another piece might have yet to be substantiated. So he's dealing with a lot too, in terms of trying to give the public information, but you have to do so responsibly, and he's got to make sure he's doing that.
I'm sure every statement he's making, he's planning out what he's going to say and how he's going to say it, to get the most mileage out of this for himself. So I would imagine all inner communications that he's had with his team and people he's talking to and how they're going to position this and how they're going to pitch it and how he's going to say it out loud at the NAACP convention in Chicago or at a funeral. I'm assuming all those intercommunications would be ripe for subpoenaing or discovery should a civil case be brought at some point in time.
Oh, totally. Because what they'll want to learn is whether Crump or somebody on his team is presenting information with some knowledge that it could be questionable or even dubious. And if there was such evidence, where they're talking in text, and I'm just saying hypothetically, I have no idea if this exists, but if there was a text that said, hey, I'm not sure you should say X in public because we haven't verified it yet. And then the response text is, yeah, but that's really going to drum up more attention. This case needs that attention. I think we got to do it. That's when you start to get in a real dicey scenario.
Go ahead, Tony. Sorry.
Yeah, it's all about expose. If there's something to expose, expose it. That is wonderful. But if there's not, you can't make shit up for your own moving your own agenda forward. If that's not there, Robin, go ahead.
Yeah, and basically riffing off what you said, Tony, are there guardrails in place for these types of situations for the communication people are allowed and expected to have that then they know, hey, I can't fall can't fall too far either way of this, that there are guardrails, or it's very subjective on every case?
Oh, it's yeah, it's entirely subjective, and different attorneys, you know, sort of are calibrated differently and have different risk tolerances, and some, you know, are bombastic and out there and willing to toe the line and sometimes step over it, whereas others are extremely cautious. And so I don't know that the guardrails would be the laws of defamation and negligence, but those guardrails can be a little flimsy.
And that's the question too. So other than defamation, which is harder. What other laws? So negligence, that's another law that could come to play here, is like what could someone pursue?
Yeah, in addition to negligence, like we talked about, possibly defamation, making a false statement about somebody if it was a statement of fact. And then another one that comes to mind is negligent infliction of emotional distress. If you're negligently presenting information with knowledge that this could really upset somebody, then that could be a claim as well.
All it takes is one crazy person. It takes one crazy person to be unbalanced in how they're taking in this information and go off the deep end and go, those people need to have this sort of consequence, fueled by speculation and false conclusions that we just don't have the answers to yet. God forbid something happened to one of Nolan's close friends that were with him that day, if they had nothing to do with this. And it's a result of some crazy person being riled up and doing something horrible to them. If that were to happen, my God. I mean, would that be a referendum on this kind of vitriol or this kind of jumping to conclusions this early in an investigation? I get the history without a freaking doubt. So anybody who's like, well, yeah, I know that it's horrible. They should be asking every damn question. It's great that there's an independent investigations going on here side by side. Mississippi has an absolute shit history of how they've treated black people up to today. They still do in many, many ways. So great. But again, if this is not that, and we're running everything through the filter, we're looking at everything and going, oh, well, looks like this is not, it's not what they had done in the past. People aren't being railroaded here for some sort of nefarious reason. This was just one of the many hundreds of drowning cases that happen every year that had nothing to do with race or something criminal. If something happens to one of those people, what does that look like, Eric, legally?
Gosh, yeah. You know, who would be responsible for that? And in what justice system forum? You know, naturally, there would be a criminal case if they identify the assailant and can prove that they did this. But on the civil side is where it gets a little more tricky, a little more complicated. Yeah. Certainly, the actor themselves could have civil responsibility, but could Crump, could somebody else who is contributing to this overly heated environment, especially if they at this juncture, you know, they already know that there have been death threats. They know that some of these actions in terms of public disclosure has led some members of the public to take extreme measures. So with that knowledge, if they continue to make public disclosures in a negligent fashion and knowing that death threats have already been levied, what's the next step after a death threat? We all know that answer. And that could be the foreseeability component of a negligence claim under those circumstances.
Words have meaning. Just as the sheriff saying so early on, it doesn't look like it's anything criminal. You don't know that yet. Words have meaning. Don't say that out loud. Same with Crump. Words have meaning. Robin?
Yeah, and going back to one of the comments and questions we had on there too, questioning the drowning, finding his body in the same area in which he supposedly drowned, if he was drowned and it wasn't foul play, with rip currents, is that someone thought it might be unusual, but it is actually common and it's possible and relatively common because the way currents flow, because of the out, the in, bottom, up, down. I did the research on it. Body was discovered by park ranger in morning of July 6th, northwestern tip of island, consistent with area known strong strong currents. In short, finding a drowning victim close to the suspected site is not unusual when riptides and local current patterns are involved. Does not by itself rule out that it wasn't drowning. So, yes, it actually happens. So I just wanted to answer that.
Happens
one
a lot.
Yep.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue our conversation right there. At the end of the day, we still don't know, and we will follow this wherever it may lead. Let's go to another case that's in the news right now. Hearings going on. David's D4VD's preliminary hearing is putting sealed evidence into open court for the first time. And what prosecutors are laying out is a digital paper trail that allegedly tracks every step from the killing to the cover-up. Defense attorney Blair Burke is cross-examining Hart, attacking how evidence was handled and what investigators never tested. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor with us in on what's landing and where the defense is planting their flag, along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. Burke allegedly ordered chainsaws, body bags. You can get it from Amazon. I didn't know this, labeled City Morgue. I guess that's where the city morgues get them. Just go to Amazon, subscribe and save. And a burn cage under a fake name, but use his own credit cards to hand everything shipped to his address. When the concealment effort is that sloppy, I mean, is premeditation even a question at that point, or what does that reveal, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, what it tells me is if he made missteps in that phase of it, allegedly, he would have made missteps in other phases too, including the killing, including things leading up to this. You know, he's allegedly on a podcast on video with Celeste as a minor sitting next to him, and they appear very close. You know, what other missteps has he made in this case? You know, now that's certainly strong evidence of the cover-up of abuse of a corpse and crimes like that. But it's not necessarily direct evidence of the murder, although I think we're kind of going that direction in this preliminary hearing.
What about the fact that from what we've understood now in the preliminary hearings, the chainsaws, I mean, it's very damning, like you ordered three chainsaws and a burn cage, the chainsaws, I guess every one tested negative for blood and no DNA testing followed. Prosecutors say those were the central to the cover up. If there's no blood on the chainsaws, is it, it doesn't quite rhyme as well as if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. But that seems to be like it would be a bit of a boon for the defense. If there's, you got chainsaws, but no blood. Maybe he was going to go trim the hedges or something.
Yeah. Maybe he was an aspiring arborist. I'm not sure, but certainly it's helpful for the defense if there was no biological material found on those chainsaws. But also, why did you buy chainsaws and a burn cage and the body bags? Like, when you look at all those things together,
yeah,
they appear extremely suspicious.
I'm telling you, so as gruesome as it is, just reverse it. Put yourself the best you can in his shoes. Again, if you're going to go down the road of, all right, if he bought chainsaws to do what we think he bought them to do, can you imagine starting up the chainsaw? You see that chain going around like a million miles an hour, and you're looking at that body, and you're now saying to yourself, oh, this is going to be a mess. I think I'll put this down, and I think I'll go down to something else. So that was my thing in the first place, way back when, chainsaws. That entire garage would be covered in a lot of DNA if you start using. I mean, if anyone's ever, so I heated my house all by wood growing up, so I'm intricately too much familiar with chainsaws and axes and everything. Wood chips go everywhere. Wood chips are a lot more solid and harder to fling around than flesh and bone. So I'm just saying, it doesn't surprise me that he started one up and decided I need to move in a different direction. Again, innocent until proven guilty.
Burke and Celeste had the matching tattoos. Prosecutors say the two fingers bearing that and a tattoo of his name were removed and have never been found. That's not suspicious at all. The finger that has your name on the dead girl has been removed. The defense position is he was not the cause of her death. How do you square that with the evidence that points straight to concealment of identity?
Yeah, that's an uphill battle. The defense is going to have a heck of a time on this. You know, there's just so many things tying David to this victim and to the body and to everything else. Let's say it was an accident. Let's say it was a drug overdose. I'm not saying that's what happened, just hypothetically, if that's how an alleged victim died. Then David wanted to sort of dispose of the body because he didn't want to get some kind of trouble, I guess. But then taking the finger off, that's really a concerted effort to ensure that this minor teen girl's dead body isn't tied to you because you have the same tattoo as her. It just like it adds a level of nefariousness. It makes it seem like this wasn't just like an accident and happenstance. They didn't know what to do and let's do something with his body. This seems like much more planned out and in terms of active concealment of one's identity.
This is like a 9-year-old psychopath that watched too much Bugs Bunny and Yosemite Sam. I mean, trying to freaking do this crap. It's just like the most ludicrous.
You know,
it's just ludicrous.
My daughter plays a lot of Fortnite, and I know that he was playing a lot of Fortnite. It kind of reminds me of like a character on Fortnite, like how they're going to take care of something. Unfortunately, when you kill the person, they don't explode into the air and a bunch of gems and weaponry doesn't fall out of them for you to carry to your next murder. I wonder if he was surprised by that little fact.
It shows a level of problem solving that he had. Zero.
Let me just put the body in my car and just like let it be.
No one will notice. And you know what? And I'll just get another Tesla. I'll just put it in the trunk. It'll be fine. No one will notice it. Someone said, get an air freshener. It's fine.
This is what happens when kids are simply like playing, you know, Minecraft to Fortnite from ages 0 to 18 and never watch an episode of Dateline. I was well versed in the horrific nature of human beings and what people could do or how to cover up a crime if I needed to.
I mean, you would think if you're going to, I mean, any cognizant human being that has a semblance of trying to function healthy in the world, when you are trying to or endeavoring to do something new, you want a new job, you want to try this new hobby, you're going to do at least a micro research, look up a YouTube video in a sense of, and so, I mean, we cover this all the time on the show. It befuddles us that people that do these things don't watch true crime. Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is, I mean, just think about this. If this moron kid, innocent, who's proven guilty, had watched one episode of our show or any other show, they would have said to themselves, oh, I better not do this way. This is just stupid shit.
Yeah,
but it just sits. I mean, they make it too easy for them to get caught.
Eric, they're saying, you know, that David was not the cause of the death, and they're gonna prove that in court. Behind the scenes, from a defense perspective, I want to try to understand what's going on here. Do you think the defense attorneys of David know what the cause of death actually was? As David said, it wasn't, I didn't do it, it was this. Or are they sitting there going, don't fucking tell us anything like that? Are they sitting there, do they even know where they're going with this? Or are they going through the motions here and the hearings and waiting for an off-ramp, waiting for an inroad or something where they can go, okay, it looks like toxicology can't prove that it was a drug overdose because she was so mutilated in that car. Are they waiting for something like that where it's like, okay, we can say that. That was the cause of death because it can't really be proven and it can't really not either, but it's better than this mountain of shit over here that points 1,000% at David. But you could also kind of mask that and go, he was panicking and he was trying to cover up his dead friend because he was afraid of being caught with a young girl that he was allegedly having inappropriate relationships with. And that's what it was all about. At worst, it's pretty bad. He's a child, but he's not a murderer. Is that the angle that you're reading here off of the defense of David right now, or what are you seeing from your perspective?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think the defense is receiving information about the cause of death from multiple sources, and they're evaluating that. They don't have knowledge that they weren't there. They don't have personal knowledge, so they're like, "Hey, the government says this. This other our defense investigation says this. I've talked with my client. I'm receiving information from multiple sources." But then you look at it legalistically, and you're like, "Hey, if the prosecution cannot rule out X and they cannot rule out Y, can we really draw a reliable conclusion about what happened regarding the cause? If they cannot rule out a drug overdose, if they cannot rule out some other accident that could have taken place, doesn't that mean that there is a potentially plausible explanation that is not unlawful? And if there's a potentially plausible explanation that's not unlawful, isn't that reasonable doubt?
Is that something that they're going to be arguing here in preliminary hearings? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, with these preliminary hearings, when they wrap up, whether it's this week or next, the judge is going to decide whether this goes to trial or not. So are they going to have to show their cards of he was not the cause of her death in these preliminary hearings before the judge makes that call?
I think they'd be stupid to, because you don't need to show your hand from the defense side of their preliminary hearing. You're going to lose that anyway, bro. That the threshold is so low, it's probable cause, that there is more than sufficient evidence to establish probable cause. If I were them, I would not show my hand. I would, really try to use the timing of things and that leverage down the road in a jury trial phase instead of saying, "Hey, prosecution, this is the horse we're riding. Now between now and the months until the jury trial, think of, 10 ways to shoot that horse."
Go ahead,
Tony. No, I was just thinking too. So if they're going to be able to argue somehow using some of these wild theories about, he wasn't the cause of her death, they still have the problem with her being underage with all the SA, correct? Because there's apparently plenty of evidence of that on his cell phone. So how's that play out if they're able to argue away other? I mean, the other is almost, if not worse.
Are we going to see additional charges?
Yeah, because there are additional charges. Yeah.
Sometimes if you got a really tough hand on the defense side, you sort of veer towards a compromise verdict. You say, "Hey, look, this guy, there's evidence that he had an inappropriate relationship. And if you choose to find him guilty on that, you choose to find him guilty on that. But there is not evidence that he murdered her, that there is not evidence of the most serious charge, just of a very serious second charge."
Yeah, because what is this? One count of continuous S abuse of a child under 14 is what the other charge is.
Yeah, I mean, there's the three special circumstances alleged, lying in wait, financial gain, murdering a witness also on there. Is there any road, Eric, here where the judge doesn't say that this is going to trial? That's obviously what's going to be decided at the end of this. What are the possible avenues of what the judge can decide at the end of these hearings?
Sure. So the judge could determine that there is probable cause for all of the charges brought and all of the charges will remain until trial. The judge could have a hybrid ruling whereby he or she says that some of the charges have probable cause. Those are moving forward. But this one, prosecution, you screwed up on one of these elements. You didn't establish venue or some sort of technicality. So I'm not going to let some of the charges go forward. I guess in theory, the judge could say there's not probable cause for any of these charges and the case is dismissed. But I think that possibility is extraordinarily unlikely.
Death is still a possibility here. The DA hasn't decided on the death penalty yet. When they're looking at this, you're a defense attorney, you're a former prosecutor. Obviously, there's still many more months of litigation that can go on here, many more hearings that can take place. Is this a case where it would be time yet to say, you know what, let's make a bargain here that they're not going to kill you and get that off the table and you're going to plead guilty? Or is, you know, is there far more litigating that needs to go on before they decide to attempt that one, if they decide to attempt that one? How would you play that?
The way I would play it is typically the prosecutor is the first person to make a plea offer if one is going to be made. And you kind of want that from defense, because if you're the one making the initial offer, you're the one coming to the table saying, hey, I know you haven't levied the death penalty officially, but if you don't kill this guy, we'll plead guilty to an extremely serious something. You're really ceding a lot of leverage and negotiational power. So you want the prosecution to come to the table first. And the way it would usually work is the prosecution would levy the death penalty, put it on the table, and then defense would say, whoa, wait a sec, let's make a deal here. But if you're coming saying let's make a deal preemptively, that might be a position of weakness and might be problematic for further negotiations, because you already kind of shot yourself in the foot.
Lots of ways this could go, and all of them seem to lead where David's going to be locked away for the rest of his life, or not on the planet. One of the two, and I think both seem very fitting. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. This is an interesting case, because so far I've heard no one on David's side. No one, not one person's been like, I don't think he did it.
Silence is deafening.
That's telling. That's telling in the case. Yeah, he was lovely.
He's a nice kid.
All right, weigh in there. Until next time, Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books and audiobooks. Leave a review on Amazon. Much greatly appreciated there. Until next time, for Eric, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.